Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome to What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insight with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. I'm on the line today with Top Chef Tom Colicchio. Tom is, of course, the award-winning chef behind Kraft, Witchcraft, Colicchio & Sons, and River Park, to just name a few of his restaurant ventures. And he, of course, is known best probably for Mr. Top Chef. He is the Top Chef. And most recently, he was a very active voice in the stunning new documentary, A Place at the Table, about hunger in America. Tom, thanks so much for taking time out of your day to chat with me. I really appreciate it.
Sure, Katie.
Now, Tom, I've known you actually for quite a while, and you have now evolved into not just an incredibly famous chef on many levels, but an activist as well. So what happened? What got you involved in doing, sort of working on issues around hunger and today's discussion, which will be antibiotics?
Sure. Well, I guess on some level, I've always been, but was also very just happy just to sort of focus on fundraising for various issues that I'm involved with, whether it's hunger or whether it's I'm on the board and very active in Children of Bellevue. It's a group that acts as advocates that are long-term and short-term in Bellevue Hospital.
Right.
I guess I've always been, but it's been a little just sort of quieter and thinking that was enough, that just raising money for these various issues was enough. And I think on the hunger side of things, when my wife started working on A Place at the Table, you start making a film, you really don't know where it's going to take you. And 3 years into it, we sort of came away with the idea that food is a political condition and can be solved with politics. And so we can keep raising all the money in the world. And I think, our industry has done a great job raising money for various groups, whether it's Share Our Strength or Feeding
City
America,
Harvest,
and
sure.
City Harvest, mm-hmm. and the New York Food Bank, but you then realize that even though these groups are doing amazing work, that it's still only putting a Band-Aid on the problem,
mm-hmm.
You realize that a more direct involvement is probably what's necessary, and then when you start taking that route, then you realize that there is a role that you can play to try to get politicians to sort of use your voice to get politicians to look at an issue and hopefully get them to buy into that and change the way they look at it.
Well, do you think in the case of antibiotics in livestock agriculture that you're going to be able to get the attention of politicians and force them to look at this issue more closely?
Well, you hope so. Unfortunately, Representative Louise Slaughter from New York is trying to get a bill out there, and she's been having a very difficult time getting any traction at all.
Oh, totally. She has introduced that bill 6 or 7 times now.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. And so unfortunately, I think for this, it's going to take a major outbreak.
That's what scares me. Yeah, absolutely. So besides having Louise Slaughter introduced, and by the way, Henry Waxman also introduced a bill. There is some movement growing in Congress, but it's so distressing to see how tight a grip the pharmaceutical industry and the livestock industry have on politics in America. So besides dealing with these legislators, what other steps could be taken, do you think? I mean, how do you think you can raise, we, all of us collectively who are interested in this topic, can raise awareness of this with consumers?
Well, I think it's the constant, the constant pressure. Pew has done a great job to raise awareness, and you have mamas, super mamas against super bugs, and there's super chefs against super bugs. And so these kind of grassroots, sort of groups are starting up, and I think that's important. I think on the restaurant side of it, we're about 95% antibiotic free in our restaurants in New York.
That's great.
And we started putting that on the menu. And
right.
to try to get people to ask, like, well, why is this important? For me, I can tell you how I sort of became aware of it, it was a couple things happened at once. George Faison, who's a great friend of mine, he's at Bragg & Spiller now, he used to be at D'Artagnan, he started to really focus on it. Mm-hmm. And I was at a luncheon, and there was he brought together various people in the industry to talk about it, and it really got my attention. And then soon after that, I had neck surgery. And 2 weeks after surgery, I got a staph infection.
Ooh.
And spent another six days in the hospital and came home with an IV bag for about a month and a half with a PICC line inserted into my chest. And, it wasn't pleasant.
Yeah, that'll put the fear of God.
And luckily, I didn't have MRSA.
I was just going to say, you couldn't have had MRSA because you're still talking.
Right. Well, I started, looking at it, and it was interesting. It was something that I was talking about, but what kind of thrust me, I guess, into the middle of it was I was on Morning Joe talking about hunger, mm-hmm. and Joe Scarborough just tossed out there, "What's the most dangerous thing right now in food, processing or in the industry?" And
sure.
I said antibiotics, and when I threw it out there. I didn't get much from him at the table, but as soon as we were finished, and various people, I guess, who were watching it sort of took up what I was saying and sort of urged me to get more involved. But when we were done, he turned to me and said, "My dad died of MRSA."
Wow.
And he got very interested. And then, I think that if you look at all these various issues, and I know we're focusing specifically on antibiotic and overuse of antibiotics in the food system for this conversation. But I think in general, if there is a food movement, and I say if because I'm trying to be provocative here, it needs to encompass everything.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to look at whether it's hunger issues, whether it's organic farming issues, whether it's antibiotic issues, GMO labeling issues, local farming communities, safety on farms, all these various things that encompass the food movement. I think there are various groups taking up individual causes. And at some point, we all need to get together with it. But what we really need to do is create a voting block of people who will vote on food issues.
Yes.
Very similar to, what the NRA has done with Second Amendment issues, or other groups have done with reproductive issues, where people will actually look at this and actually vote on that particular food, and again, the big food issue.
Right.
And that's how I think you get a political power and can change political will.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that, but we'll see. I mean, those are two very powerful lobbies that we're working against, and I'm going to read a little something that I wrote about this. Now, I do a lot of work around the meat industry. I'm really interested in it, and always have been, and that's one of the reasons why we know each other, is because I've interviewed mm-hmm. you about steaks,
sure.
and a couple of other types of heritage meats and stuff. But the meat industry, I can tell you from reading everything that they put out in terms of their trade journals, they are in total denial. In fact, yesterday I listened to a guy from Feedstuffs who's been reporting on agricultural issues for 25 or 30 years, his whole career, and he went into a rant about – not a rant. He went into a discussion of how the science is really kind of not there about antibiotics and antibiotic-resistant microbes being linked to overuse in agriculture. He also disputed, as I've seen in many other publications that cover the meat industry, they dispute any link between human and animal transmission, even though there are studies that are showing that MRSA, for example, is being transferred from pork to humans. And
mm-hmm.
and the thing that really strikes me about that, and I'll just I'll shut up in a minute and let you talk, is that this level of denial is something that is very difficult to counteract. I mean, they will buy as many studies as they need, is my impression, to say what they want to say. And it is rather difficult to pinpoint these links between overuse of antibiotics in livestock and what we're seeing now in terms of the rising levels of new strains of E. coli, of Campylobacter, Salmonella, et cetera, that are all antibiotic resistant. So first I want to ask you, could you ask your wife, please, to make a documentary about this issue?
Yeah. Unfortunately, these ag gag laws, it's really getting hard to get in there.
No kidding. Yeah. I've done a lot of coverage around that, too. I mean, that's a very frightening thing. And I'm actually giving a talk to the Animal Agricultural Alliance Summit on Activism in a couple weeks about what a disastrous public relations move that is, if nothing else. Yeah. But one thing I wanted to bring up with you was, you know, in regarding all of this, when you were talking about raising consumer awareness and what you can buy, I wanted to touch briefly on the whole idea of marketing and labeling as being one way to really sell this idea through. I was speaking with a guy who writes for Forbes in a previous show, and he was saying the way to make these people come to the table is to talk to their profits and not talk to them about what they should or shouldn't do. It's like, can you make more money by providing antibiotic-free meat? If the answer is yes, then that's what you should be selling. What do you think about working on that level instead of trying to force them through legislation? Do you think that that's something that restaurant chefs could get behind and help to lead the charge with?
Yeah, I think that's fine. I think that restaurants can play a huge part in raising the awareness. But unfortunately, at the level that you have to pay for antibiotic-free meats, this is something that will only affect a small part of the population. So I think on the chef side of things, it's great to help raise the awareness, but I don't think it's enough. Mm-hmm. The idea of speaking to people's purses, I get that, and it is often very effective, but you have to increase demand for it.
Yes.
Because if the demand's not there, you're not going to get people switching over.
Exactly.
And so I think it creates demand. And again, I'll say this, as I said earlier, I think that demand will be created when there's an epidemic. and that's what it's going to take. I don't know. You know, when you have, the CDC is testifying in front of Congress that that there is a definitive link between, routine non-therapeutic use for antibiotics. You have the American Medical Association supporting that position. You have the Academy of Pediatrics supporting that position. So you have healthcare providers that understand this and are supporting that position. So, yeah, you can find people on the meat side of things that are going to go out there and find all the studies in the world, but I think you'll have plenty of people on the other side as well to support the fact that this is a problem. But again, I still believe that there will be, a major outbreak. When you have the AMA and it was a couple weeks ago, came out and said that, you know, something as simple as a strep throat or scratch
could
we'll
become
start killing people.
Yeah, could become life-threatening. But yeah. Tom, can you stay on the line? We're going to play a very quick sponsor drop and come right back with Chef Tom Colicchio, who is joining me to talk today about antibiotics in our food system.
You're listening to Leaving by Dead Stars on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years, so it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
We are back with Chef Tom Colicchio talking about antibiotics in our food system. This is Katie Kiefer from What Doesn't Kill You on the Heritage Radio Network. Tom, thanks again for joining me today. I want to go back to what we were talking about before the break, which was the cost thing. And one of the things, I mean, obviously you're the right guy to ask about, what is the bottom line in terms of you? You said that you have about 90% antibiotic-free meat in your New York restaurants, implying that other restaurants elsewhere are not able to achieve that. But for somebody who's not as big a deal as you are, like, how do they manage that? And how much pushback do you get from investors or partners in restaurants to try to go in that direction?
The actual expense, it's hard to say. We just started working on this a couple months ago. It definitely, you know, we had to pass along some of those prices to consumers, and we can. And again, we actually trained our staff to talk about some of these things. So yeah, there's a cost associated with the actual terms of dollars and cents. I'm not 100% sure just yet. We still have a little more work to do before we can figure that one out. So yeah, but as far as investors, they're behind it because it's also part of our overall approach to food. Whether we're looking to support local farmers, whether we're looking to buy organic vegetables, buy meat that's humanely raised. And so once you start going down that route, you just kind of you start looking for other ways to sort of include a better and more just food system.
Right.
And so it's okay to get out there and talk about some of the stuff, and you got to look at what you're doing, at home. I have a hard time going, up on the hill and lobbying people and saying this is what we're looking for. If they could point a finger at me and go, well, what are you doing in your restaurant?
Yes, of course.
And so, so that was part of it. But also, the more you start looking at our the way we're producing food, and if you're looking for that system that is more just, more equitable, and you're looking for food that's healthier, you have to start looking at the entire picture. And this, again, it's personal because I was affected by a staph infection, but also it just made sense by our mission and our message around food. And you can't pick and choose. To me, it's either you're kind of all in, to stay above the fray. And I think it's also somewhat. It can hurt the industry, and it's somewhat deceitful when people claim to be for this just a new food system, and yet they're not going all in.
Yeah, well, you brought up the major point, which is that it's costly to go all in. And I think that with the best intentions of the world, a lot of chefs still have to answer to somebody about it. Maybe not everybody. Like in your group, they're into it. And somebody else who's maybe in a mid-level restaurant or a new restaurateur or doesn't have a lot of extra cash, I think it's really hard to go down that route in general, never mind the expense of antibiotic-free meat.
Right. But you pointed out earlier, there is, I go into even... I have a house out in Long Island on North Fork, and I go to my local, shopping food store, and they have antibiotic-free chicken.
Yeah.
We picked it up yesterday for chicken soup, so it's there. People are buying it. If people weren't buying that, it wouldn't be there.
Absolutely.
And this isn't in, this isn't in the Hamptons. This is in a farming community in Matatuck, New York.
Right.
And people are buying it. People are interested in it. And so more and more people are going to ask for it. The more people ask for it, the price will start coming down.
I think so, yeah.
And so, again, this is part of educating people and letting people know that there is an alternative. I think that looking at why these drugs are being used. In 2011, it was almost 30 million pounds.
Yeah,
it was 29.9 pounds of antibiotics that were sold for meat and poultry production.
Yeah.
Only 7.7 million were used for humans.
Tom, you have got your numbers absolutely spot on, dude.
I tried.
You're very good.
You have to ask why. And what we know, it promotes growth, and we know these animals couldn't survive in these CAFOs unless they're pumped up with these antibiotics.
That's correct.
And so do you say to yourself, God, if we have to produce food like this, and we know it's affecting us, we know it's creating these superbugs, why do we keep doing this?
Because it
makes
money.
Why do you support it?
I think first of all, I think the meat industry, they of course, fighting tooth and nail against this, and they'll say two things about this. This is what I've read. One is that if you reduce antibiotic use, sort of daily antibiotic use in animals, you will promote disease and suffering, which is true, because they live in those confined area feeding operations. And the reason that we use confined area feeding operations is because, one, the animals grow to market weight faster, and two, it's much cheaper. And that's what Americans want. Americans want cheap meat. And that's the answer of the food industry. It's like, this is how we keep our costs down, is we feed them this very high, very low dose antibiotics to keep them disease free and to keep them growing faster so that we can feed them less, get them to market weight faster, and everybody makes more money, including the shopper. So it's really hard to sort of argue with that. And I think that...
No, I think it's very easy to argue with that.
Oh, I really? How do you tell consumers they want
it? Effective.
They don't count in the environmental costs of raising meat that way, which are quite significant.
Yes.
So in fact, but it looks cheap to the average American consumer. When you can go to McDonald's or Applebee's or whatever it is and buy what you buy for, you know, a few bucks, then that's a cheap meat supply to the average consumer who is uninformed about what
you're not seeing the real cost of it.
And exactly.
Then when you factor in the amount that our tax dollars are subsidizing corn.
Uh-huh.
You know, that are feeding the animals, and so
right.
you're not actually experiencing the real cost of food.
No, you're
both
not.
On an environmental level, on a human level, and I think also what's going to happen in terms of healthcare.
Right.
And so it's a Faustian bargain. I think eventually it will change when we start seeing. That we cannot control these bugs anymore.
Right. Well, I mean, we're already seeing that. And as I say, the industry is completely in denial. I mean, I interviewed a woman named Maren McKenna a few months ago who wrote all about this new strain of E. coli that causes urinary tract infections. And it's directly attributable to poultry, to handling poultry. I mean, it's absolutely cut and dried, basically. The science is all there. And this is not, you know, it's just not really making it its way through the channels so that people absolutely understand what's going on here. It's really, really frustrating, actually. As somebody who's been covering this issue for almost 3 years, I'm only just now seeing a lot of newspaper, you know, mainstream coverage of this issue. It's like, who's paying who to keep their mouths shut about this? It's quite upsetting.
I think that some of these, you know, I was with Mary Nussel a couple months back, and she was talking about going on the Hill and lobbying. She was talking about this food movement, and they turned around and said, what are you talking about? Yeah. She said, well, you know, food movement. So, you know, she goes, no one's up here talking about it. So as long as no one's up here, there's no food movement.
That's right.
And so I think that, these issues, it just takes time. And you look at GMO labeling.
Yeah.
I think that several states are probably going to have, you know, ballot initiatives, and they'll probably pass. I think it was easier for these chemical companies. We're able to pour a ton of money to defeat that in California.
Yes.
But I think if you have more ballot initiatives in different states, I think as many as 14 states, I think there's 26 states actually, may have initiatives, it can be very, very difficult to start defeating that. And so you start getting traction.
Yes.
And then if certain states start to pass that, then you end up with a patchwork full of laws that don't work anymore. And so then something has to happen on more of a federal level. And so I think that, you know, with antibiotics, it's starting to get traction. And you see it happening. You know, a couple years back, 3 or 4 years ago, you never heard anything.
Never.
Very small. And now it's starting to pick up a little traction. You're starting to hear, you know, a little bit of a rumbling. And I think it's just going to keep growing and growing and growing. But I think that, you know, you got to keep the pressure on. And I think debunk the science.
Yeah,
or prove the science on your side of it, and find the right amount of sort of activism, both from the scientific community, from the consumer community, from chefs, from other food activists, sort of everybody together. And I think once you have that sort of group of people all talking about it, then you make some change.
I hope that's true. I mean, I given that Congress was able to defeat background checks, even despite 90% of the country supporting it, it's obvious these guys aren't working for us anymore, right?
Yeah, I think that's a little more complicated. Again, I think that the NRA has managed to get that kind of power, and they only have 4 million members.
Yeah.
But they have that kind of power because all 4 million vote, and they vote that single issue.
Right.
And that's what goes back to what I said originally, where you need to create a voting block of people that are interested in food issues. And once you do that, then you have power. And power doesn't have to be in tons of numbers. It has to be just people who are willing to vote that single issue.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And that, I think, is, you know, will sort of get people's attention. You look at, I don't think we're over with the background checks. I think it's kind of ridiculous that people didn't have the political will to vote along with that, but we'll see what happens in the 14 elections. I think it could be a very effective wedge, and we'll see. And listen, these things. You look at immigration. Immigration may finally get passed. Why? Because it's clear that immigration and immigrants and recent immigrants and also sons and daughters of immigrants will start voting.
Yes.
And can swing elections. And without them, you can't win on a national level.
Yeah, that's right.
And when you look at red states starting to turn purple because of immigrants, whether Nevada,
yeah,
possibly Texas soon,
yeah,
you know, even Arizona soon, it's all starting, you know, Florida, you know. So, again, I think that once it gets to that level, then I think politicians will sort of take notice. But only it has to rise to that level.
Yeah, it does. And I, you know, I'm just, I'm, you know, with all of the money and power behind pharmaceutical companies, never mind the meat industry, it's going to be a real slog, I got to say. But, you know, I hope that you're right. And I hope that that people start really paying attention to, you know, especially guys like you. And especially, are you going to be going up to Congress to testify about this yourself? Say if PAMTA comes up for a vote again?
Oh, I will. I'm going tomorrow, and I'm meeting with some people from Pew tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
I'm actually going up with Michelle Nishan and Wholesome Wave to,
oh, I love
to do
Michelle.
Some work to support,
yeah,
Sherrod Brown's food farm jobs bill.
Fantastic.
And so we're going there tomorrow. I'm meeting with some people from Pew, and I think I'm meeting with Louise as well tomorrow. But yes, if it comes up, I will. I mean, I'm you know, I testified when the school you know, lunch reauthorization was up, and although I was scared to death doing it, I'm a little more comfortable now.
And, I saw you. You were great.
I think when you realize that, and for me, you know, it's not about celebrity. I'm not doing this because I'm a celebrity. I'm doing it because I have kids, and,
sure,
you know, I care. And, you know, this is open to anyone who wants to do this. You know, it was kind of neat when you go up to the Hill, you see all these coalitions of people that are there,
mm-hmm,
you know, trying to make their voice heard. And that's, how, you know, it's kind of what our government's about.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, by, you know, for the people, by the people, for the people. And if the people aren't raising their voices, then, you know, government would just kind of do what it does.
Absolutely. Well, and that's what's happened with food. I mean, you know, I love all the activism, but, you know, let's face it. We asked the food industry to provide us with cheap food. They
right.
did. And right. now, because it sucks, we're mad at them. I mean,
we
it's
got,
like,
we got what we asked for.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's yep. just like, wait a minute. You know, you got to work with these people. You can't expect them to stop everything they're doing. What about CAFOs, like, on the dime? I mean, it's got to be a transitional
right.
experience. Well, Tom, unfortunately, I have to wrap this up, even though you are the most interesting guest I possibly have ever had. No, that's not true, but you are definitely way up there in the top one or two. So why don't you give us a sense of, like, where we can see more about your activist things? I'd love to have you describe this Super Chefs Against Super Bugs organization, which I have never heard of.
You know, let me,
because we can look it up, here. And we'll put it up on the website.
It's actually, I think, a group that's split off of the, you know, the supermoms, I think.
Uh-huh.
I think that's what it...
I'll research it.
Yeah, I think it's there.
And, of course, a place at the table.
I think Pew is actually coordinating that.
Okay. Well, I have several friends in the Pew organization, so I will query them about that. Tell us about Place at the Table. Where can people see that?
Well, right now, you know, it's a doc, so it doesn't have a long-lasting, you know, on-screen presence.
Mm-hmm.
But you can download it on demand or on
Excellent.
iTunes. And we're about to start our sort of second round of distribution,
mm-hmm.
and that is actually to community groups and colleges. And so if you are interested in showing the film to a community group, kind of reach out to us. You can do that through...
Oh, really?
Through our website, Take Part. There's a way to sort of create a community screening. And so that's sort of the next round. But it is available on iTunes and on demand.
Fantastic.
And it's, you know, it's doing what we thought it was, you know, going to do. Again, changing – the idea was to really change the face of hunger.
Yes.
I think too often we're conditioned to think of hunger as in terms of third world hunger. And it's changed. It's all around us. One in six Americans are food insecure. So it's
yeah.
all around us. And so being able to identify that and being able to empathize with that, I think is important. And then change the conversation, especially moving it away from this idea of welfare and moving it towards this idea of investment. Especially when it comes to children, 17 million mm-hmm. children that are food insecure. So I have to give this idea that if they're showing up for school hungry, they can't learn.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this is an investment in the future. When you look at national security, you know, only 25% of people who are showing up to join the military service are fit to serve.
I know.
Because of obesity. And then, again, understanding that obesity and hunger are kind of neighbors.
Yes.
And so, this is, you know, we wanted to get that conversation rolling. We wanted to add to the dialogue and hopefully, through those little subtle changes in the conversation, get more people on both sides of the aisle sort of focusing on it. You know, we did it back in the 70s. We got rid of hunger, and it was
yeah.
a combination of Dole and McGovern, you know, getting together and creating the modern safety food network and our safety net, and Nixon signing it signing that bill. And so, you know, it can happen again, but I think we need to, again, change that conversation and get people looking at the issue a little differently.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Tom, thank you very, very much for joining me today. I really appreciate your time.
Sure.
You're a wonderful guest, and I hope you'll come back and join me again soon.
Anytime. Thanks.
Take care. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This has been an episode of What Doesn't Kill You, and we'll be back next week. Thanks so much for listening, folks, and thanks to my sponsor. So long for now.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.